and watch the patrols tonight and see if we can anticipate any chance to slip through. I'll fetch you from here when we're ready to sail. Where are we sailing? Percy asks.
Out to the island.
I nudge the vellum in his direction. His eyes scan the page.
We'll go in the morning as quick as we can, Scipio says. Is that a problem?
No, that's soon, Percy says.
A band takes up on the street outside, a whole slew of voices joining it in drunken song.
Scipio sighs through his nose.
The sooner we can quit this place, the better.
What about our ransom? I ask.
We'll have to do the exchange elsewhere. Once we have your spoils from the island, we'll move to Santorini in the Aegean. Our buyers there will harbor us while you write your families. I'm not staying here for months waiting for them to send someone for you if there are posters everywhere advertising a reward for your capture. Stay out of sight tonight.
We will, Percy says, but Scipio swats his hat at him as he departs.
Not you I'm worried about.
I make a face at his back, then take one of the mugs from Percy, the one he didn't half finish between the bar and the booth, and down most of it in four swallows. Percy is still staring at the notice, folding and unfolding its corner with his thumb. A black crinoline crushes up against the other side of the window beside our table, like the wings of a raven, as a woman stumbles, the crowd pushing her from all sides. His gaze flits up.
Sounds like a gay occasion on the street.
Sounds like the sounds of...
I give up halfway through that sentence. Too many versions of the same word and not enough of a preliminary idea where I was going with it. And instead put my forehead against his shoulder. Percy laughs.
How much have you had to drink?
Some.
Some?
Some of the drink.
Well, there's my answer.
He slides the glass he just brought me out of reach.
Ha! I already finished that.
Wait, where are you going?
We are going up to bed. You're bashed and I'm shattered.
No, come here.
I grab his hand as he stands and pull him back down onto the bench beside me. He nearly lands in my lap. He laughs, but doesn't let go of my hand, instead tucking his thumb against my palm and giving my fingers a soft squeeze. Recklessness rises suddenly inside me, like flotsam disrupted from the seafloor, at the feeling of his skin against mine, and that terribly fond smile flirting with his lips.
I want to go out.
That is a terrible idea. We are being hunted, remember? He pokes at the notice.
It's a large city, and a party.
Are those meant to hide us, or are you listing things you enjoy?
What's the use of temptations if we don't yield to them?
That will be chiseled on your tombstone. He presses his shoulder to mine. Come on, bed. Scipio told you to stay in.
No, he said stay out of sight. They're entirely unrelated. And we're not sailing until the morning, so he'll never know. And we shall wear masks like everyone else and be out of sight entirely.
I blow at a strand of hair that has come loose over his ear.
Please come. I feel like we haven't been together in a long while, and I want to be out. With you, specifically. Out with you.
I bring our still-clasped hands up to my mouth and deal a quick kiss to his knuckles. Even before he speaks, I know what his answer will be. It's written in the way his whole being melts like tallow when my lips touch his skin. He lets out a dramatic sigh, then says,
You're an enormously stubborn pain in the arse when you want to be, you know that?
Is that a yes?
Yes, I'll come out.
Really?
No, don't answer. I shan't give you a chance to change your mind.
Let's away.
Our hands fall apart when I stand, but he keeps his fingers upon the small of my back as I lead him from the booth, across the packed barroom, and out into the steaming, raucous night. The rain has taken a recess, though the clouds are still coffered and low. Percy and I follow the masses to the square of St. Mark's, which is a riot of people. Everyone's drinking. A creative array of libations are being sold from carts, and we taste some fine wine from silver taste vin and some less fine wine from less fine cups, sharing a glass between us like we've done our whole lives, though suddenly it feels strangely intimate to put my mouth where his was just a moment before. Someone hands us masks made from stretched animal skin and dyed black and white, and Percy ties mine for me, his hands twining in my hair before he draws me back for a look with his fingers linked behind my neck. I laugh at his mask, and with a wide smile he flicks at the long nose of mine. As we shoulder our way down the street, we walk close enough that our hands sometimes knock. The air is full of colored smoke drifting from firecrackers and bottle rockets set off from the bridges and over the water. Music is playing from so many different places that all the notes tangle into a strange dissonant symphony. People are dancing. They are standing and singing and arguing and laughing. They are lounging on the bridges, packed into gondolas, and hanging off the prows, shrouded in the light from lanterns and firecrackers and torches, on balconies and in doorways, touching each other like the whole city is familiar. I see a ginger-haired man lean over the rail of a bridge and lift his mask so he can deliver a quick kiss to another man with a thick beard. And zounds, I never want to leave this place. I glance over to check if Percy saw that, but beneath the mask I can't tell. It's hard for me to think of anything other than what he might be thinking, and what this night means to him, and if it's the same as for me. Here, in the bellow of this music and the torchlight dyed as it flickers through the Murano glass that lines the shop windows, it's easy to pretend we're sweethearts, ordinary as anything, out for a night together in a brilliant city we have never known. Though I could have done without any of it, the drinking and the partying and the revelers in a whirlpool around us, so long as Percy and I were together. The world could have been a blank canvas, and I still would have been exactly this livid with happiness, just to be with him. The crowds thin as we wander from the Grand Canal and the Square of St. Mark's. Revelers stumble in pairs and small knots, their faces still covered, and most heading for the Basilica Square. When we cross the next bridge into an empty alley, I make a snatch for Percy's hand, and he laces his fingers with mine and gives them a squeeze. Fetch me a couch, for I nearly swoon. Aren't you glad we came out? I say, swinging our hands between us. It's like being back home. Except not at all, and so much better. Better because the gin doesn't taste like piss. And no one wants to play bleeding billiards. And there's no Richard Peel. We hate Richard Peel, he shouts, which gets me laughing so good I have to stop walking. See? This is what our tour was meant to be like, I say as he drags me after him down the street. There have been far more thrilling heroics than advertised. Thrilling heroics suit you, though. You know what suits you? Hmm? That bit of a beard. I snatch his mask off so I can get a better look, and he laughs, one hand flitting to the scruff along his jawline, like he might wipe it away. Go on, mock me all you want. No, I mean it. I like it. You look good. So do you. He tugs the mask off my face, that fond smile again curling about his mouth, though it slips as he qualifies. I mean, you always look good, but now you look... Not good. Wait, I mean, yes, good. You always look good, but you don't look good so much as you look... Better? Dear Lord, ignore me. Under that handsome scruff, his face is rather red. I smile, and Percy laughs again, then swings his arm around my neck and pulls me against him, pressing his lips to my forehead. The street is still shiny with the afternoon rain, and the canals are jumping as the first soft drops of a new rainstorm strike them. The lantern light shafts across the black water in chords and whirls, and Percy is right there beside me on that beautiful, glowing street, and he is just as beautiful and glowing as it is. The stars dust gold leafing on his skin, and we are looking at each other, just looking. And I swear there are whole lifetimes lived in those small, shared seconds. It takes a moment, an embarrassingly long moment, of resting in his gaze and mentally encouraging myself before I lay my hand upon his cheek and bring my face up to his. It is remarkable how much courage it takes to kiss someone, even when you are almost certain that person would very much like to be kissed by you. Doubt will knock you from the sky every time. I nearly start to cry when his lips touch mine in return. Pain and ecstasy live tight-knit in my heart. It's a very gentle kiss at first, close-mouthed and chaste, one of his hands rising to cradle my chin as if each of us wants to be certain the other is in earnest. and his lips part a smidge, and I nearly lose my head. I grab him by the front of his shirt and pull him against me, so forcefully that I hear the seam at the neck pop. He takes a deep breath as his hands go under my coat, his mouth firm for a moment, before it softens, and then opens against mine. His tongue snakes between my teeth. We're so wrapped up in each other that we stumble a bit, and he presses me backward against the alley wall, bending down so I don't have to stand quite as high on my toes to reach his mouth. The bricks tear at my coat like briars as I pull his hips to mine so I can feel him going stiff. We're so close that there's not a thing between us but the rain, each drop feeling like it might sizzle and spark on my skin, a spitting quench against molten metal. He's fiddling with the waistband of my trousers, and a shock goes through me when his cold fingers meet the bare skin along my stomach. "Do you want to?" His voice comes out ragged and breathless, and he doesn't finish, just hooks his finger in my waistband and tugs. "Yes," I reply. "Yes?" "Yes, yes, absolutely yes." I'm already fumbling with the buttons along the flap, cursing everything I drank that's now making my fingers fat and awkward. But Percy stops me. "Not here, you tomcat. There are people about." "There are no people about." As though prompted, someone calls to his mate from the other end of the street. A few dark silhouettes run through a barrel of lamplight. I reach for the buttons anyway, but Percy threads his fingers between mine and pulls my hand away. "Stop. I won't let you take your trousers off in the middle of the street. That is a terrible idea." "Right. Well, shall we keep kissing until we think of a better one?" He brushes his mouth against the corner of mine, and Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, it takes every ounce of the not inconsiderable restraint I've spent years exercising around Percy, not to rip all my clothes off right then, passers-by be damned. But I am nothing if not a gentleman, and a gentleman does not take his trousers off in a public place, particularly if the great love of his life is asking him to refrain. "What if we went away together?" he says. "Back to the inn, because I could certainly take my trousers off there." "No, I mean after this is over."
"What's over?"
"This tour, this year." He kisses me on the forehead, a soft, breathy peck. His face is bright. "What if you didn't go home and I didn't go to Holland, and instead we went somewhere together?"
"Where somewhere?"
"London, Paris, Jakarta, Constantinople, anywhere, I don't care."
"And what would we do there?"
"Make a life together."
"You mean leave forever?"
"We can't." "Why not?"
"Because we'd have nothing."
"We'd have each other, isn't that enough?"
"It's not."
I don't mean for it to come out so abrupt, but it slaps that dreamy excitement off Percy's face. His brow furrows. "But if we left together, I wouldn't have to be put away. If I was with you..." I can't quite wrap my head around this strange reversal between us, because it is always Percy who is the sensible one, and me with the feverish notions. But here he is, proposing we run away together with nothing but each other like some sort of star-crossed pair in a broadside ballad. And while my heart is ready to burst for loving him, love is not a thing you survive upon. You can't eat love.
"Think it through, Perce. We'd have no money. No livelihood. I'd lose my title. I'd lose my inheritance. We'd ruin our reputations. We could never go back."
"I can't go back, no matter what." When I don't say anything to that, he takes a step away from me, our hands falling apart. "What about your father? You'd go back to him and that estate work, English society, before you'd go away with me.
God, Monty, what are you more afraid of? Him or not having all the privilege his money buys you?"
Now it's my turn to step away. I'm not certain how we've slid from his hands down my trousers to the sharpest Percy's ever spoken to me. It makes my head spin. "Come on, Percy, be sensible."
"Sensible? I'm being put away in a madhouse at the end of this year, and you're telling me to be sensible. Or..."
I almost reach for his hand, like touching him will somehow tamp the anger and panic puncturing his words.
"Or we find the panacea and it works, and you can come home with me because you've been cured."
"I don't want it."
"What?"
"I don't want the cure-all. If we find it, I'm not going to use it."
"Why not?"
"Because I'm not going to take this woman's life so I can be well again. And I don't think I have to be well to be happy. God." He takes another step away from me, head tipped back to the sky.
I should have said that ages ago.
Ages? How long have you been thinking this?
Since Dante told us about his mother, before that even. Monty, I've never wanted it.
Never?
Not never. At first, the idea of finding Mateu Robles and him having something that could make these fits easier to manage was appealing, because epilepsy is hard. It is so hard to be ill. But I'm not going to take someone else's life. It's not worth that.
So why did you let us come all this way?
Let you? He repeats, the words feathered by an astonished laugh. I didn't let you. You never gave me a choice. You never gave me a choice about anything, about speaking to Mateu Robles, or taking the key, or going with the pirates. You never think what anyone else might want but you. And now you're only interested in being together if it doesn't require any sacrifices on your part.
And you using the panacea is, what, a sacrifice for you to be well again? Are you sacrificing your illness for me?
What do you want me to say? Yes, I'm ill. I'm an epileptic. That's my lot. It isn't easy and it isn't very enjoyable, but this is what I've got to live with. This is who I am, and I don't think I'm insane. I don't think I should be locked up, and I don't think I need to be cured of it for my life to be good. But no one seems to agree with me on that, and I was hoping you'd be different. But apparently, you think just the same as my family and my doctors and everyone else.
I am losing ground. It's giving out from under me all the certainty I'd nursed over the past few weeks since learning of the key and the heart. Certainty about him and me and us, and how all that needed to happen to go back to the way we were was for Percy to be cured. But I'm realizing suddenly that this has always been Percy. It was never a barrier until I knew. So it's not something wrong with him. It's just me who's driven this wedge between us.
But we'd have the panacea. If we ran away together now, you'd still be ill. Nothing would change.
He folds his arms.
So which is it? Do you want me to be well to keep me from an asylum, or so you don't have to deal with me being ill?
Does it matter?
Yes.
Then it's both, all right?
I don't want to lose you to an asylum, but this...
It would be so much easier on both of us if you were well. God, Purse... We've got enough in our way. Why this too?
Whatever things we have standing in our way, this isn't one.
Fine.
I wrench the key out of my pocket and throw it to him, perhaps a bit more at him than to him.
There. Now it's yours. Do whatever you want. Make yourself well, or run away, or toss it in the goddamn sea for all I care.
I expect him to keep arguing, but he doesn't. All he says is,
All right.
Shout at me, I want to tell him, fight back because I deserve it. I deserve to be fed all the ways I've made him feel unwanted, slapped with my own selfishness. But he's Percy, so he doesn't say another cruel word. Even at his worst, he's so much better than me. His shoulders slump and he swipes a hand under his eyes.
I'm going to bed, he says. And tomorrow morning, I'm going to have a word with Scipio about getting away from here. And I don't think you and I should see each other for a while.
Wait, Percy!
No, Monty, I'm sorry.
He starts to walk away, stops, and raises his hands like he might say something more, then shakes his head and leaves me. I don't know what to do. I stand there, silent and stupid and absolutely in pieces as Percy walks away. I watch him until he's gone and I'm certain he won't come back. The hour strikes. Church bells around the city all begin to clamor. The air quakes. It starts to rain again very softly. I don't want to think about it. Can't think about it. Got to shut up that voice in my head telling me that I've just lost the only good thing I had because I couldn't get out of my own self. All this while I'd spent thinking we could never be together because we're both lads. But it's not. It's because of me. He asked, and I couldn't give it up. Can't think about it. We'll do absolutely anything not to think about it. I follow the revelers back towards the piazza, my mask lost somewhere back in the alley and my face bare. And I know what I'm going to do, which is drink until I can't even remember this night happened. Back along the Grand Canal, it's easy to find cheap, virulent gin. Easier to drink it until everything smudges and I start to feel like I can leave myself behind. I take 4 shots of it in quick succession, chased by ambiguous ale and clear spirit straight from a bottle I have to reach behind a bar for. The skyline slants. The moon turns black. It feels like everyone around me is screaming, and I am not thinking about Percy.
Monty. Hey, Monty. Henry Montague.
I raise my head, and there's Scipio, one hand on my shoulder and his face a bit distorted, like he's standing behind glass. I've that mostly empty spirit bottle clenched in one fist, and also I cannot remember where I am, sitting on the edge of a bridge overlooking a canal which narrows down possible locations not at all. A gondola passes beneath me, a woman in a blood-coloured dress perched on the prow with her train dragging behind her in the silver water.
Monty, look at me.
Scipio crouches down so our faces are level.
You all right, mate?
I'm excellent. No, that's not a word. See, I was going to say excellent, and then instead I went with...
Monty.
How are you?
I stand up, roll my ankle on the cobbles, and nearly fall over. Scipio flies to his feet and catches me.
Let's get you to bed.
No, I can drink more.
I'm sure you can.
I hold out the bottle. Have some.
No, it's too late for me.
Right. It's late. It's late.
I laugh. Scipio doesn't. He pries the bottle out of my hand and empties it into the canal. I try to snatch it back and miss so spectacularly, I would have pitched into the water if he hadn't had a hold on me.
What do you do that for?
Because you're bashed. Come on, to bed.
No, can't.
Why not?
Bed is where Percy is, and Percy doesn't want to see me again.
He mentioned something about that when he came in. You two got each other quite worked up.
Scipio tosses the bottle into the canal, then claps me on the back.
He'll calm down.
I don't think so.
Why not? Your friends, friends quarrel.
I ruined everything. I always ruin everything.
I let my forehead fall against his shoulder, and I can tell from his awkward grip on me that neither of us is quite certain what it is that I'm doing, but we don't move.
Goddamn Percy!
Scipio pats me on the shoulder, flat-handed, then pries my forehead off him like he's pulling up a floorboard.
You can sleep on the ship if you're so keen not to see Percy. I told you not to go out. People are after you, remember? You're going to get us all strung up.
He wraps an arm around my shoulders, and I fall a bit more into him than I mean to, and let him pull me back through the crowd. I trust Scipio to lead the way, either to the docks or the inn, wherever he feels it best to take me. The first landmark I recognize is the Campanile in St. Mark's Square, a needle poking at the moon. Percy and I stood here together just hours ago in the shadow of the bell tower, and goddamn Percy, I'm so angry at him I want to punch something. But it's just me and Scipio and crowds of strangers. None of those seem like good options. Someone slams shoulders with me, and someone else screams right near my ear, and I pull up short, suddenly drowning in the night. Scipio stops as well.
Come on, Monty, we're turning in.
I need to... I can't.
I'm breathing too fast, and he must notice it, for he steps closer to me.
What's the matter?
I press my hands into my cheeks, regret rancid inside me, and I want to cry so badly, like that might flush it all out. Scipio steps behind me and puts his hands upon my shoulders.
You need to sleep. See how you feel in the morning.
Percy doesn't want me anymore,
I murmur. Scipio's hand flexes, and I'm not certain if he knows what I mean and ignores it, or simply interprets that sentence in the holiest way.
He'll come around.
He starts to push me forward, and I let myself be pushed, but someone plants himself in our path. My feet aren't as quick as my brain, though that isn't performing at top speed either, and I crash into him. Scipio toes the back of my boot, and I step out of it.
Scoozy.
Scipio keeps a hold of me as he tries to go around the man, who I realize is dressed in the livery of the Doge's soldiers. The man steps into Scipio's path again, a deliberate move this time, and Scipio halts. I'm still standing on one foot, trying to get my boot back on, and he nearly pulls me over. The soldier asks us something in Venetian, and we both stare back, blankly. Scipio answers in French.
Excuse us.
The soldier steps in his path again. Scipio's grip on my arm goes tighter.
Do you speak English?
The soldier asks, the words fumbled like he doesn't understand the phrase, just the sounds individually. Scipio, still sizing him up, then says, in English as well,
Yes.
You English?
The soldier says it more to me, and I nod before I realize I am. Someone grabs me from behind and I'm wrenched away from Scipio. My muscles seize up. It's another soldier, this one square-jawed and hugely tall, with missing front teeth and the same livery. I'm starting to catch up to what it is that's happening, panic hot on its heels, and I try to yank away from him, but I'm too tipsy and he's a good deal bigger than me, and he takes my feeble resistance as a reason to twist my arms behind my back like they're made of cloth. I yelp in pain. Scipio is putting up a much more successful fight than I am, enough that two more soldiers are called over from where they were lurking unnoticed in the shadow of the cathedral. The soldiers are speaking to each other in Venetian, and Scipio is trying to argue with them, first in French, then English, which none of them seem to understand. I don't know what anyone is saying, so I try to get free again, this time taking the boneless approach in the hope that a sudden collapse will twist my arms free. But the officer hauls me up by the back of my shirt, saying something right in my ear, and I'm flailing to get away when Scipio suddenly says, Monty, stop! The fear in his voice stills me. And when I look over, one of the soldiers has drawn his knife, the blade so thin it's almost invisible until the moonlight catches it. He has the tip of it held to Scipio's throat. I stop fighting, and the soldier wrenches my hands behind me again. Then the four of them begin to march us across the square, a soldier on either side, and the fourth bringing up the rear with that wicked dagger drawn. They don't take us far. We shove through the crowd, pressed from all sides by feathers and crinoline and bays, strings of pearls whacking at us as they're tossed over shoulders, until we're before the Doge's palace on the edge of the canal. The soldiers at the door, same uniforms as our escorts, let us pass without a question. And we're prodded across a courtyard rimmed in white stone colonnades, then up two flights of stairs and through a set of large ebony doors. The room beyond is dominated by a massive four-posted bed. Dark wood panels fringed in gold scrollwork run all the way to the ceiling, where the winged lion of St. Mark looks down from the frescoes. A white glass chandelier drips wax onto the carpeting. The light of it nearly blinds me, and I throw my hands up, face curling in protest. I hear the door shut behind us. The soldier holding me finally lets go and says in French, his words whistling from his missing front teeth,
Are these the gentlemen you are looking for, my lord?
One of them,
a sickeningly familiar voice replies.
I've no notion who that cove is.
I lower my hands. The Duke of Bourbon is rising from an emerald chaise, Helena with him, perched forward on a window seat across the room. Her plaited hair swings over her shoulder as she squints at Scipio.
Who the devil is that?
One of the corsairs that brought them into port, I'd wager,
Bourbon replies.
I was informed of their arrival this morning by the dock officials. Was there anyone else with them?
He asks the soldiers.
No, my lord, just the pair.
Where are your friends, Montague?
Bourbon calls to me.
I was hoping you would all be in attendance this evening.
My heart is really going now. Sober up, I think. Sober up, get your head on straight, and sober up and get out of here. The soldier has sheathed his knife, so I try to make a break for the door, but misjudge where I'm standing and slam shoulders with Scipio. One of the soldiers grabs me by the collar and shoves me into the bed. The backs of my legs hit the footboard, and I topple over it, landing on the mattress with a dusty flump. The metallic tang of blood bursts in my mouth.
What have you done to him?
Helena asks.
He's drunk,
the Duke replies, nose wrinkling. Then to the soldiers again he says,
Thank you, gentlemen, you may leave us. The fee will be arranged through your patron.
As soon as the Doge's men are gone, Bourbon seizes me by the arm. He's got a massive pistol with an engraved barrel jammed into his belt, and the grip rams me in the stomach as he drags me back to my feet.
Hand it over, Montague,
he says, one hand resting upon his belt. Perchance I failed to notice what is essentially a small cannon beneath his coat.
When I speak, my words run together, partly from the drinking, but more from the fear. I haven't got it.
What do you mean you haven't got it?
The Duke paused at the pockets of my coat, overturning them, then wringing them between his hands like I might have sewn the key into the lining.
He has it, I know he does, Helena says from behind him. Keep quiet, he growls at her. They took it from the house. I said keep quiet.
Bourbon grabs me by the chin, jerking my face close to his so that a thin mist of spittle freckles my cheeks.
Where's the key?
He shakes me hard and my head slams backward into one of the bedposts.
Where is it? Leave him alone.
Scipio grabs the Duke by the arm and tries to pull him off me, but Bourbon takes a swipe in his direction. The blow lands with a wet crack, and Scipio stumbles backward, trips over a footstool, then slams into the wall.
Stay away, sirrah, Bourbon snaps at him. You'll stand at the gallows when I'm finished with you.
Scipio stays doubled over, his face pressed into the crook of his elbow and his shoulders heaving. Swing back, I think desperately to him, and hopelessly to myself. But neither of us does. Fighting back against everyone who cracks you is a luxury we both stopped believing in long ago. Helena is on her feet now, back to the wall, with her hands flat against the paneling.
What do we do?
She says, so quiet she must be speaking to herself. Bourbon pivots to me again, the soles of his boots making a soft shush upon the rug.
Where's the damned key, Montague?
I haven't got it, I stammer. I can feel a thin line of blood running down my chin from where I bit my lip, but I'm too stuck with fear to wipe it away.
Then who does? Tell me, where is it?
When I don't reply, he shoves me backward into the bed again and I collapse without protest. There's a moment of cacophonous silence. Outside the window, the revelers in the square make themselves heard, a pretty and oblivious sound. I can feel the Duke staring at me, like he's still waiting for my reply, but I'm not sending this man after Percy and Felicity. I'd rather die now at his hand with the hope they get away.
Fine, Bourbon snaps. Then his voice shifts as he turns. You, pirate, stand up. Stand up.
I raise my head as Scipio straightens. The skin on one side of his face has been scraped raw by the encrusted rings Bourbon wears, and thin tracks of blood are beginning to rise, jewel-colored against his dark skin.
You will deliver yourself to Montague's two companions, who are undoubtedly in your care, Bourbon instructs.
He's speaking slowly like Scipio's a simpleton.
You will inform them they are to meet us on the island of Maria Emata at dawn, alone, with the Lazarus key, and none of you pirates in accompaniment. If they fail on any of these accounts, I will shoot Mr. Montague and dump his body in the lagoon.
He pulls his pistol from his belt and pantomimes it for fullest effect. Bang. I let my head fall back against the bed. Another moment of silence, then he cocks the pistol, a sound like a snapping bone.
If you don't get along, Bourbon says, I'll shoot him now.
A moment later, the hobnails in Scipio's boots complain against the floorboards. Then the door shuts, and I'm alone. As soon as he's gone, Helena cries, like she's been holding it in.
Don't shoot him! Keep your head, Condessa.
There's a clatter, something heavy tossed onto a wooden surface so hard it rattles everything upon it.
Christ, women are volatile!
She's standing between us, I realize suddenly, as though she doesn't trust him to keep that pistol away.
No one else is dying for this. And he shan't, so long as that key of yours is in my possession tomorrow morning.
I'm starting to drift away. My senses are each becoming unfamiliar things in turn, my vision graying, and my hearing slipping out to sea like a message tucked into a bottle. This bed is going to swallow me whole. A shadow falls across me, and I push my face deeper into the mattress.
Let him sleep until we depart, Helena says. He'll be no good to us until he's sobered up.
Outside the windows, the sky explodes. A fireworks show is beginning. The storm clouds flush, each raindrop a colorful lantern, and the crooked finger of a moon hanging low over the palace turns blood-colored.
I want to be home. No, not home. I want to be not here. I want to be somewhere safe. Somewhere I know. I want to be with Percy. Sleep well, my lord, I hear Helena say, and I surrender.
28. When I wake, I'm still curled up at the end of the bed, my knees aching and my shirt stuck to my back. My head throbs. I haven't a clue what time it is. It's too colorless to tell. Outside the window, the sky is gray and frothy, though it blushes suddenly white with the tongue of lightning. The water of the Grand Canal bounces as the rain peppers it.
Are you going to be sick?
I raise my head. The Duke is gone, but Helena is on the window seat, twisting her necklace around her fingers. I don't answer, because I don't believe a prisoner owes his captors any sort of report on his health. That, and if I'm going to be sick, I prefer to do it all over her, and I prefer it to be a stealth attack. Helena retrieves a porcelain basin from the washing table and brings it over to me. I expect her to toss it onto the blankets and then go back to her sentry post, but instead she sits down at the head of the bed, one leg pulled under her and the basin between us. We examine each other for a moment, me with considerably more squinting and wincing. She's different here, away from her father's house and her own terrain. She seems more human, with less armor around her emotions, and for a moment I believe she simply wants this finished. Then she says, "How did my father look?" I hadn't been expecting that, not the subject, nor the gentleness of her tone. How did... What?
When you saw him in prison, was he unwell? Did he look as though he'd been mistreated?
He was... I'm not certain how to answer, so I choose... Emphatic.
Emphatic about what?
That his children not turn over their mother's heart to the Duke of Bourbon or any man who would use it wrongly.
Her face sets. You mean a man such as you? You want to use it as well, don't you? That's why you stole the key once Dante told you about our father's work.
We wouldn't use it wrongly.
And who decides what is wrong and what is good?
Your father said,
I love my father, she says, each word ironclad. That is the only thing that matters to me in this world, and I don't care what has to happen for him to be free again.
She smashes the wrinkles from her skirt with the heel of her hand, eyes away from me.
So who was it for?
Percy.
Your friend?
She presses her fist into the mattress, her shoulders never losing their graceful slant, but her head drooping in something like penitence.
I'm sorry.
For what?
I don't know, she says. I'm just sorry.
Before I can reply, the door bangs open and Bourbon sweeps in, the shoulders of his cloak speckled with the rain. Helena flies to her feet so fast the porcelain basin is almost knocked to the floor. Bourbon tosses his hat upon the chaise.
Am I interrupting something?
Did you find a boat? Helena asks.
A gondola, he replies. We'll get past the patrols easier in something small. Get up, Montague, he barks at me, sweeping back the tails of his coat so I can see he's still keeping company with that pistol the size of his forearm. I stumble to my feet, nearly pitching into one of the bedposts. Dawn approaches.
Bourbon scoops up his hat from the chaise, then bows me out the door.
We're going sailing.
The Doge's palace sits with its back to the canal, thin docks jutting over the waves like limbs. A sharp black gondola is tied off at the end of one, bobbing in the choppy water. The Duke shepherds us into the boat, Helena ahead of me. She hangs a lantern at the prow and takes up the pole without consult, leaving Bourbon and me sitting face to face, regarding each other, his pistol resting loosely in his lap. Helena steers us down St. Mark's, between the tall ships and the ferries, until we are spat into the lagoon. We float alone in the water between the city proper and the surrounding islands. As we pass the harbour where we docked the day before, I scan the sails, searching for the Eleftheria among them. But she isn't there. The gondola strikes a wave, and a gulp of frigid water soaks my knees. After what must be near an hour, the silhouette of Maria e Marta blots the horizon. It's a small spit of lonely land. Before the water invaded the churchyard, it could likely have been walked end to end in a half of an hour. The only piece still above the waterline is the chapel built upon a hill, its spire a compass to the sky.
"Here they come," Helena says quietly.
Two catboats are gliding toward us, a few men in uniforms of the Doge's soldiers standing at their prows. Bourbon raises a hand to them, tucking his pistol under his cloak, but careful to keep it pointed at me.
"Good morning," he calls.
"You're out early, my lord,"
one of them returns.
"We came to see the island. My nephew here..."
He claps me upon the knee, and I flinch more than I think a nephew believably would when clapped by his uncle.
"He's on tour, and I promised him a close view before it goes into the lagoon."
"It's quite unstable," the guard calls.
"We won't get too near."
Look at me, I think, as the soldier's gaze drifts across the three of us, though he seems far more occupied by Helena, who's perched at the back of our gondola like an inverse figurehead. Look at me and sense that something is wrong. Make us turn back. Arrest him before he shoots me. Tell us to have a good look from here and then go home.
"Keep your distance," the soldier says. "One of the walls collapsed this past week. Wouldn't want your nephew to be crushed."
Bourbon gives a good-natured laugh.
"We'll stay far away, sir."
The catboats go their way and we ours. My heart sinks to the bottom of the lagoon as we draw ever nearer to the jagged ruins of the remaining sanctuary walls, their silhouette a gap-toothed smile against the sky. We approach the chapel from the east above what used to be the graveyard before it was submerged. Through the sudsy water, the silhouettes of gravestones ripple and distort. The wings of St. Mark's lions jut out of the water like dorsal fins, marking the gateposts every few feet. The chapel facade is ghostly in the corpse-grey light of dawn. Flecks of quartz in the walls sparkle. We disembark on a submerged dock, ours the only boat in sight. The loneliness of it makes my heart heave. The water hits me above the knee, funneling around my legs as we hike to the chapel, and the rain picks at me from above. The whole damn world seems made of water. The sanctuary seems more fragile and precarious from the inside, like one good sneeze might topple the whole thing. The doors creak as the water sluices against them, a crusty line of scum marking the level. Beneath the waves, the floor is slick marble set in a chessboard pattern, so every other step feels like a hole I might tumble into. The silence is absolute, but for the occasional splash as mortar drops from the ceiling, and the haunted trembling of the waves crawling into corners and scraping against the bottom of the pews. Bourbon strides up the aisle, lifting his feet high so that each step splashes.
"Where are we going, Condessa?"
he calls to Helena, and his voice echoes like the sound of the ocean in a shell. A shard of the cracked rose window falls. "Down," is all Helena replies. The waves carry her skirts behind her like ink spilled from a pot. Helena leads us to a chapel off the altar. It's higher than the rest of the sanctuary, so the flooding is no more than puddles collecting between the tile. A single tomb sits in the center, two figures carved prostrate upon it. They're both women, one with her hands steepled in prayer, the other with two fingers held to her thumb. Above the tomb, a few lines of scripture are painted. "It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, 'Take ye away the stone.'" Helena sets her lantern upon the ground, then works her fingers beneath the lid. "Help me," she says to me. I don't move.
"I'm not overturning a saint's tomb."
"They are biblical women," she says, like that's an explanation. "Their bodies aren't here, only their relics."
"So?"
"So this isn't a real tomb." She jerks at her end of the lid, and it slides out of place with a screech. A gasp of hot air escapes, smelling of earth and bone and a long, deep dive. Beneath the lid, a spiral staircase sinks into the darkness. "Help me," she says again, and I take the other end. Together we heave the lid off the tomb. With the stone taken away, Bourbon joins us, all three staring downward. That air billowing up feels freakish, both for its temperature and for its steady rhythm, like the thump of a heartbeat. I'm swallowing fear in short, sharp gasps. Bourbon draws out his pistol, then jerks his chin at Helena.
You first.
Suddenly, I'm not certain which of us is more his prisoner, she or I. Helena takes up her lantern again and lights a votive candle at the head of the tomb, the glass holder filled with flood water, but the wick dry enough to catch. I think for a moment she's going to pray before we descend, but then I realize she's leaving a calling card for Percy and Felicity, so they know where to go if they come. As the flaxen light curls across her skin from below, her face looks empty, any emotion wiped away like rain fog from a window pane. For a moment, I think she must be too far gone for the gravity of this moment to take root inside her, our shared moment earlier no more than a play act. Then I realize it's the sort of empty that presses out everything else. Like if she isn't vacant, it will fill her up and soak in like a stain. I recognize it because I've worn it before. Hollow yourself or the fear eats you alive. Helena is not afraid. She's terrified. I follow her down the steps without prompting, the Duke bringing up the rear with his pistol at my back. The stairs are built in a tight spiral, so round and narrow we have to go single file with our hands on the wall for balance. The air gets hotter the deeper we go, which seems to be the opposite of what's natural. At the base of the stairs, Helena raises her lantern so we can all see the corridor ahead. The sallow light doesn't reach far, but in its glow I can see the walls are pocked, their surface raised and rippled, like they're made from paper that has been soaked, then dried in waves. We've gone a few meters in silence, when the lantern light glances off a bend, and I suddenly realize what it is that's forming those swollen patterns upon the walls. Bones. The whole corridor is fashioned from bones. Rows and rows of them stacked as high as the ceiling, browning and polished by the drafts of hot air billowing over them. Skulls are hung at intervals between them like sconces, brittle spiderwebs threading them together. Where the corridor bends again, there's a whole skeleton assembled, dressed in dusty capuchin robes and wired upright with a sign hung around its neck. Helena leans forward so her lantern illuminates the inscription. Eramus quod estis, sumus quod eritis. I haven't used Latin since my Eton days, and I wasn't what could be called attentive in my study of it, but she translates. What we once were, that you are now. What we are now, soon you shall be. Another gust of the hot air breathes over us. We go on down the gallery of bones, quiet but for the occasional rumbling, like a great giant shifting in his sleep. The ground beneath our feet is a mosaic, grooves worn into the glossy tesserae by funeral processions bringing down their bodies. I imagine Mateu Robles here carrying down his dead but not wife, his conscience heavy as her alchemical heart. The hall ends in a vaulted ceiling and three columns of skulls, a doorway behind them framed in what seem to be femurs. I try not to look too closely for fear it might send me into a dead faint if I do. Helena doesn't move any farther. Bourbon tips his pistol at me, so I reach for the latch, only to find that it's not a latch at all, but a skeletal hand, reconstructed and sitting in its place so that it has to be held for the door to open. A shudder goes through me head to toe, and I give a fast tug. The door creaks open with a shower of dust. The tunnel gives a moan. I step into the tomb. 29. The tomb is small and dusty, one wall lined with rows of vaults built into the stone. The highest one is just above my eye level. Each drawer is made of polished black stone with a mother-of-pearl inlay, a family name inscribed upon each beneath the handle. Robles is carved upon the center drawer, a prominent keyhole built into a slick silver frame just beneath the B. On either side of the vaults, two iron bowls are suspended upon crossed legs, and when Helena touches her lantern to them, the dry kindling inside writhes to life, smoky fingers scratching the darkness in chorus with the hot air that seems to gasp from the walls. Bourbon does a quick sweep around the room, his cloak tossing up dust from the corners. Helena hangs her lantern on a hook beside the door, then walks up to the drawers, fingers tracing her family name before she presses her palm flat to the polished stone, head bowed. His lap finished, Bourbon leans back against the vaults, heel scuffing the black stone.
"Now," he says, one finger fiddling with his pistol, "we wait for your friends to bring me my key, Montague."
"It isn't yours," Helena says, so quiet I almost don't hear her.
"Then whose is it, Condessa?"
Bourbon barks, but she doesn't say anything. Her forehead is nearly touching the stone vaults.
"Yours? Your brother's? Mr. Montague's? Your mother will have died for naught if none of us use it."
He knocks on the drawers. The ceiling groans, a geyser of dust misting down upon us.
"Your father is a cowardly, wasteful fool for hiding her this way."
"He isn't," I say, my voice breaking on the last word, but I feel suddenly obliged to stand up for Helena. Or perhaps not so much her as her father, the man whose coat I wore to the opera, and who spoke about his daughter when she was small enough to tie a string from her finger to his. Perhaps that means I'm defending her as well. She used to be that small girl, after all. Perhaps she still is, the girl who loved her father so much she'd give anything to again be close enough to have that string between them. Bourbon shifts his gaze from Helena to me.
"Would you like to discuss cowardly fathers, Mr. Montague? You'd school us all."
"What?"
"I assumed you robbed me on his instructions or in some sort of desperate play to aid him. He's been looking to knock me out of favor for years.
My father wouldn't instruct me to steal from any man. As much as I might loathe him, I'm certain of that. He's far too stiff-collared.
He may not care for you, but he's a gentleman." "Your father's a rake," Bourbon spits the word. "About as filthy a man as I've ever had occasion to meet."
"What are you talking about?"
"Don't you know?"
A slow smile stretches over his lips.
"Since we are waiting, let me ask you this, Montague. Do you know what your father likes?"
A pause. I'm not certain if this is a rhetorical question and I should keep silent, or if he's using my father's favorite strategy of a rhetorical question I'm still meant to answer, so I'll look stupid. But before I can work it out, Bourbon supplies.
"Your father loves nothing so much in this world as slow ponies and other men's wives."
A jolt goes through me like a missed stare.
"You're lying."
He flicks his thumb at the handle built into the Robles' tomb. Helena's shoulders rise.
"I knew him when he was young and living in the French court. He was a bastard even then, squandering his father's money on horses and cards and always screwing someone else's woman. The wives and intendeds of his friends, those were always his favorites. And then he got himself a wife of his own."
I have a brief moment of wondering if, all these years, my father's been unfaithful and if Mother knows. But then he goes on,
"Some French girl in the country. He ruined her and then tried to run, but her father badgered him into marriage."
A ripple of that hot air nearly knocks me off my feet. I almost grab Helena.
"He had it. He must have annulled it."
"Too late for that," Bourbon says.
"When he refused to stay and accept the consequences, he called for me to rescue him. He couldn't tell his family, they'd have turned him out, and all his friends hated him by then. I got him back to Paris and helped get him married off the continent. The country wench probably couldn't have found him if she tried, but better not to take the chance.
His family never knew. I suspect your mother doesn't either, that her union to him is invalid, as he had one already when it was formed.
It's only he and I that know the truth."
"And you?
So, tell me, Montague."
He leers at me, a toothy grin that the firelight licks.
What do you think of your father now?
My head is pitching in a way that has nothing to do with the drinking from the night before. It's hard to take it all in this single heaping dose, but what I think at once is that my father, my Reformation of Manners Society father, the man I've lost years of my life ducking my head before, racked up debts and ruined women and then ran from it all rather than claim the consequences. I'm thinking that my father lies, and maybe the foul things he's fed me about myself for my whole bleeding life were just as untrue. That my father cheats. That my father has no pedestal from which to hand down judgment on me for my sins. He's not a gentleman, any way you might unravel the word. He's a scoundrel and a cowardly one at that.
Running out of time, Bourbon says suddenly, as though there's any way he can gauge the hour in this pit. Perhaps your friends don't care for you after all.
He hefts the pistol from his belt and I flinch, but Helena steps between us.
Don't you dare shoot him.
I'll shoot him if I goddamn like. This island is sinking around our heads, and my key has been taken by pirates and children. If your mother's bewitched heart isn't in my hand by the end of this day, Condessa, your father will rot for the rest of his life. I'll see to it.
Bourbon lifts his pistol, but Helena doesn't move. Neither do I, though that's a far less gallant thing to be noting. There's something quite ungentlemanly about cowering for your life behind a lady, but if Helena wants to put herself between Bourbon and me, I'll not refuse that gift. But the Duke freezes suddenly, pistol still leveled, with his head cocked toward the door. I can hear it too, a dry, slapping echo coming down the corridor of bones behind us. Footsteps. Bourbon looks to the door of the tomb, but Helena looks to me. Our eyes meet, a strange, solemn hush in the middle of a storm. Then she steps back, leaving nothing between me and Bourbon, but before he can make good on his promise to shoot me, someone shouts, "Stop!" I've only got a second to get a good look at Percy standing in the doorway, Felicity at his side, both of them panting like they've been running, and both dripping wet from the floodwater, before Bourbon grabs me from behind and drags me in front of him like a shield. The cold press of his pistol noses my temple.
"Where's my key?" he calls.
Percy fumbles in the pocket of his coat, his other hand raised above his head, until he comes up with the toothy Lazarus key and holds it up to the light. It casts a frail shadow across the vaults.
"It's here. Take it, please. Take it and let Monty go."
"That's it?"
Bourbon says, his head tipped toward Helena for an answer.
"That's all?"
Helena nods.
"Unlock it for me, then,"
Bourbon calls to Percy. Percy blanches.
"What?"
"You held me. Unlock the drawer. I'm sure you can work out which one. Quickly, please."
The pistol jerks against my skin, and I let out a soft whimper, without meaning to. Percy winces. The Duke still has one arm clamped around my chest, so tight it's hard to breathe. Or maybe that's just the fear stopping me up. Percy steps forward slowly, hands still raised, and then slides the key into the hole in the Robles' drawer. As he turns it, there's a series of clicks, like a stick's being dragged up a stack of vertebrae. The drawer pops open. Percy stumbles backward to where Felicity is frozen, looking as frightened as I've ever seen her, raw, naked fear, no battlements to hide it. Helena and Bourbon both advance, and I'm still wedged before the Duke, so when they cozy up to the drawer and peer in, I'm forced to as well. For one strange moment, I think it's Helena in the vault. But the woman lying there, pale and naked, is older, her nose thinner and chin rounder. Her hair covers her bare shoulders in shimmering waves, and I can smell the perfume off it. Her skin, too, looks newly oiled, like the funerary rites were done just before we arrived. Her eyes are open, and the whole of them is black, as though they've been filled with nightshade. Stitching runs up the center of her torso from her navel to her collarbone, a scarlet sheen pressing against her skin from the other side, like a lantern tossed beneath a sheet. Neither dead nor alive. I understand suddenly, in a way I hadn't before. No one but me had had to see her to realize this would be taking a life. "That's my mother," Helena says, soft as a prayer, and I look up at her. She's staring down.